Chapter 9, Rewriting the Textbook, Teaching Students to Question Knowledge. No schooling was allowed to interfere with my education. Grant Allen. A decade ago, if you had told Erin McCarthy she would become a teacher, she would have laughed. When she graduated from college, the last thing she wanted to do was teach. She was fascinated by history, but bored by her social studies classes. Searching for a way to breathe life into overlooked objects and forgotten events, Erin started her career working in museums. Before long, she found herself writing a resource manual for teachers, leading school tours, and engaging students in interactive programs. She realized that the enthusiasm she saw on field trips was missing in too many classrooms, and she decided to do something about it. For the past 8 years, Erin has taught social studies in the Milwaukee area. Her mission is to cultivate curiosity about the past, but also to motivate students to update their knowledge in the present. In 2020, she was named Wisconsin's Teacher of the Year. One day, an eighth grader complained that the reading assignment from a history textbook was inaccurate. If you're a teacher, that kind of criticism could be a nightmare. Using an outdated textbook would be a sign that you don't know your material, and it would be embarrassing if your students noticed the error before you did. But Erin had assigned that particular reading intentionally. She collects old history books because she enjoys seeing how the stories we tell change over time, and she decided to give her students part of a textbook from 1940. Some of them just accepted the information it presented at face value. Through years of education, they had come to take it for granted that textbooks told the truth. Others were shocked by errors and omissions. It was ingrained in their mind that their readings were filled with incontrovertible facts. The lesson led them to start thinking like scientists and questioning what they were learning. Whose story was included? Whose was excluded? And what were they missing if only one or two perspectives were shared? After opening her students' eyes to the fact that knowledge can evolve, Erin's next step was to show them that it's always evolving. To set up a unit on expansion in the West, she created her own textbook section describing what it's like to be a middle school student today. All the protagonists were women and girls, and all the generic pronouns were female. In the first year she introduced the material, a student raised his hand to point out that the boys were missing. Erin replied, "But there's one boy. Boys were around. They just weren't doing anything important." It was an aha moment for the student. He suddenly realized what it was like for an entire group to be marginalized for hundreds of years. My favorite assignment of Erin's is her final one. As a passionate champion of inquiry-based learning, she sends her eighth graders off to do self-directed research in which they inspect, investigate, interrogate, and interpret. Their active learning culminates in a group project. They pick a chapter from their textbook, choosing a time period that interests them and a theme in history that they see as underrepresented. Then they go off to rewrite it. One group took on the civil rights chapter for failing to cover the original March on Washington, which was called off at the last minute in the early 1940s, but inspired Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic march 2 decades later. Other groups revised the chapter on World War II to include the infantry regiments of Hispanic soldiers and second-generation Japanese soldiers who fought for the U.S. Army. As Erin told me, it's a huge light bulb moment. Even if you're not a teacher by profession, you probably have roles in which you spend time educating others, whether as a parent, a mentor, a friend, or a colleague. In fact, every time we try to help someone think again, we're doing a kind of education. Whether we do our instruction in a classroom or a boardroom, in an office or at our kitchen table, there are ways to make rethinking central to what and how we teach. With so much emphasis placed on imparting knowledge and building confidence, many teachers don't do enough to encourage students to question themselves and one another. To figure out what it takes to change that mindset, I tracked down some extraordinary educators who foster rethinking cycles by instilling intellectual humility, disseminating doubt, and cultivating curiosity. I also tested a few of my own ideas by turning my classroom into something of a living lab. Looking back on my own early education, one of my biggest disappointments is that I never got to fully experience the biggest upheavals in science. Long before it ever occurred to me to be curious about the cosmos, my teachers started demystifying it in kindergarten. I often wonder how I would have felt if I was a teenager when I first learned that we don't live on a static flat disk, but on a spinning, moving sphere. I hope I would have been stunned. And that disbelief would have quickly given way to curiosity, and eventually the awe of discovery and the joy of being wrong. I also suspect it would have been a life-changing lesson in confident humility. If I could be that mistaken about what was under my own 2 feet, how many other so-called truths were actually question marks? Sure, I knew that many earlier generations of humans had gotten it wrong, but there's a huge difference between learning about other people's false beliefs and actually learning to unbelieve things ourselves. I realize this thought experiment is wildly impractical. It's hard enough to keep kids in the dark about Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. Even if we could pull off such a delay, there's a risk that some students would seize and freeze on what they learned early. They could become trapped in an overconfidence cycle, where pride in false knowledge fuels conviction, and confirmation and desirability biases lead to validation. Before you know it, we might have a whole nation of flat earthers. Evidence shows that if false scientific beliefs aren't addressed in elementary school, they become harder to change later. Psychologist Deborah Kellerman writes, "Learning counterintuitive scientific ideas is akin to becoming a fluent speaker of a second language. It's a task that becomes increasingly difficult the longer it is delayed, and one that is almost never achieved with only piecemeal instruction and infrequent practice." That's what kids really need: frequent practice at unlearning, especially when it comes to the mechanisms of how cause and effect work. In the field of history education, there's a growing movement to ask questions that don't have a single right answer. In a curriculum developed at Stanford, high school students are encouraged to critically examine what really caused the Spanish-American War, whether the New Deal was a success, and why the Montgomery bus boycott was a watershed moment. Some teachers even send students out to interview people with whom they disagree. The focus is less on being right and more on building the skills to consider different views and argue productively about them. That doesn't mean all interpretations are accepted as valid. When the son of a Holocaust survivor came to her class, Erin McCarthy told her students that some people denied the existence of the Holocaust and taught them to examine the evidence and reject those false claims. This is part of a broader movement to teach kids to think like fact-checkers. The guidelines include: 1, interrogate information instead of simply consuming it. 2, reject rank and popularity as a proxy for reliability. And 3, understand that the sender of information is often not its source. These principles are valuable beyond the classroom. At our family dinner table, we sometimes hold myth-busting discussions. My wife and I have shared how we learned in school that Pluto was a planet. Not true anymore. And Columbus discovered America. Never true. Our kids have taught us that King Tut probably didn't die in a chariot accident, and gleefully explained that when sloths do their version of a fart, the gas comes not from their behinds, but from their mouths. Rethinking needs to become a regular habit. Unfortunately, traditional methods of education don't always allow students to form that habit. It's week 12 of physics class, and you get to attend a couple sessions with a new highly rated instructor to learn about static equilibrium and fluids. The first session is on statics. It's a lecture. The second is on fluids, and it's an active learning session. One of your roommates has a different, equally popular instructor who does the opposite, using active learning for statics and lecturing on fluids. In both cases, the content in the handouts are identical. The only difference is the delivery method. During the lecture, the instructor presents slides, gives explanations, does demonstrations, and solves sample problems, and you take notes on the handouts. In the active learning session, instead of doing the example problems himself, the instructor sends the class off to figure them out in small groups, wandering around to ask questions and offer tips before walking the class through the solution. At the end, you fill out a survey. In this experiment, the topic doesn't matter. The teaching method is what shapes your experience. I expected active learning to win the day, but the data suggests that you and your roommate will both enjoy the subject more when it's delivered by lecture. You'll also rate the instructor who lectures as more effective, and you'll be more likely to say you wish all your physics courses were taught that way. Upon reflection, the appeal of dynamic lectures shouldn't be surprising. For generations, people have admired the rhetorical eloquence of poets like Maya Angelou, politicians like John F. Kennedy Jr. and Ronald Reagan, preachers like Martin Luther King Jr., and teachers like Richard Feynman. Today, we live in a golden age of spellbinding speaking, where great orators engage and educate from platforms with unprecedented reach. Creatives used to share their methods in small communities. Now they can accumulate enough YouTube and Instagram subscribers to populate a small country. Pastors once gave sermons to hundreds at church. Now they can reach hundreds of thousands over the internet in megachurches. Professors used to teach small enough classes that they could spend individual time with each student. Now their lessons can be broadcast to millions through online courses. It's clear that these lectures are entertaining and informative. The question is whether they're the ideal method of teaching. In the physics experiment, the students took tests to gauge how much they had learned about statics and fluids. Despite enjoying the lectures more, they actually gained more knowledge and skill from the active learning session. It required more mental effort, which made it less fun, but led to deeper understanding. For a long time, I believed that we learn more when we're having fun. This research convinced me I was wrong. It also reminded me of my favorite physics teacher, who got stellar reviews for letting us play ping pong in class, but didn't quite make the coefficient of friction stick. Active learning has impact far beyond physics. A meta-analysis compared the effects of lecturing and active learning on students' mastery of the material, accumulating 225 studies with over 46,000 undergraduates in science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. Active learning methods included group problem-solving, worksheets, and tutorials. On average, students scored a half letter grade worse under traditional lecturing than through active learning, and students were more than 1.5 times more likely to fail in classes with traditional lecturing. The researchers estimate that if the students who failed in lecture courses had participated in active learning, more than $3.5 million in tuition could have been saved. It's not hard to see why a boring lecture would fail, but even captivating lectures can fall short for a less obvious, more concerning reason. Lectures aren't designed to accommodate dialogue or disagreement. They turn students into passive receivers of information rather than active thinkers. In the meta-analysis, lecturing was especially ineffective in debunking known misconceptions, in leading students to think again. And experiments have shown that when a speaker delivers an inspiring message, the audience scrutinizes the material less carefully and forgets more of the content, even while claiming to remember more of it. Social scientists have called this phenomenon the awestruck effect, but I think it's better described as the dumbstruck effect. The sage on the stage often preaches new thoughts, but rarely teaches us how to think for ourselves. Thoughtful lecturers might prosecute inaccurate arguments and tell us what to think instead, but they don't necessarily show us how to rethink moving forward. Charismatic speakers can put us under a political spell, under which we follow them to gain their approval or affiliate with their tribe. We should be persuaded by the substance of an argument, not the shiny package in which it's wrapped. To be clear, I'm not suggesting eliminating lectures altogether. I love watching TED Talks and have even learned to enjoy giving them. It was attending brilliant lectures that first piqued my curiosity about becoming a teacher, and I'm not opposed to doing some lecturing in my own classes. I just think it's a problem that lectures remain the dominant method of teaching in secondary and higher education. You can expect a lecture on that soon. In North American universities, more than half of STEM professors spend at least 80% of their time lecturing. Just over a quarter incorporate bits of interactivity, and fewer than a fifth use truly student-centered methods that involve active learning. In high schools, it seems that half of teachers lecture most or all of the time. Although there is evidence that middle schoolers score higher on math and science competency tests when teachers dedicate more time to lecturing than active learning. It remains to be seen whether lectures are more effective with younger students, or whether the gap is driven by the ineffective implementation of active learning methods. But lectures are not always the best method of learning, and they are not enough to develop students into lifelong learners. If you spend all of your school years being fed information and are never given the opportunity to question it, you won't develop the tools for rethinking that you need in life. There's only one class I regret missing in college. It was taught by a philosopher named Robert Nozick. One of his ideas became famous thanks to the movie The Matrix. In the 1970s, Nozick introduced a thought experiment about whether people would choose to enter an experience machine that could provide infinite pleasure but remove them from real life. Nozick predicted that most of us would ditch the machine because we value doing and being, not just experiencing, and because we wouldn't want to limit our experiences to what humans could imagine and simulate. Later, philosophers argued that if we did reject the machine, it might not be for those reasons, but due to status quo bias. We would have to walk away from reality as we know it. To investigate that possibility, they changed the premise and ran an experiment. Imagine that you wake up one day to learn that your whole life has been an experience machine that you chose years earlier. And now you get to choose whether to unplug or plug back in. In that scenario, 46% of people said they wanted to plug back in. If they were told that unplugging would take them back to real life as a multimillionaire artist based in Monaco, 50% of people still wanted to plug back in. It seems that many people would rather not abandon a familiar virtual reality for an unfamiliar actual reality. Or maybe some have a distaste for art, wealth, and sovereign principalities. In his classroom, Nozick created his own version of an experience machine. He insisted on teaching a new class every year, reflecting, "I do my thinking through the courses I give." Nozick taught one course on truth, another on philosophy and neuroscience, a third on Socrates, Buddha, and Jesus, a fourth on thinking about thinking, and a fifth on the Russian Revolution. In 4 decades of teaching, he taught only one class a second time. It was on the good life. He explained, "Presenting a completely polished and worked out view doesn't give students a feel for what it's like to do original work in philosophy and to see it happen, to catch on to doing it." Sadly, before I could take one of his courses, he died of cancer. What I found so inspiring about Nozick's approach was that he wasn't content for students to learn from him. He wanted them to learn with him. Every time he tackled a new topic, he would have the opportunity to rethink his existing views on it. He was a remarkable role model for changing up our familiar methods of teaching and learning. When I started teaching, I wanted to adopt some of his principles. I wasn't prepared to inflict an entire semester of half-baked ideas on my students, so I set a benchmark. Every year, I would aim to throw out 20% of my class and replace it with new material. If I was doing new thinking every year, we could all start rethinking together. With the other 80% of the material, though, I found myself failing. I was teaching a semester-long class on organizational behavior for juniors and seniors. When I introduced evidence, I wasn't giving them the space to rethink it. After years of wrestling with this problem, it dawned on me that I could create a new assignment to teach rethinking. I assigned students to work in small groups to record their own mini podcasts or mini TED Talks. Their charge was to question a popular practice, to champion an idea that went against the grain of conventional wisdom, or to challenge principles covered in class. As they started working on the project, I noticed a surprising pattern. The students who struggled the most were the straight-A students, the perfectionists. It turns out that although perfectionists are more likely than their peers to ace school, they don't perform any better than their colleagues at work. This tracks with evidence that across a wide range of industries, grades are not a strong predictor of job performance. Achieving excellence in school often requires mastering old ways of thinking. Building an influential career demands new ways of thinking. In a classic study of highly accomplished architects, the most creative ones graduated with a B average. Their straight-A counterparts were so determined to be right that they often failed to take the risk of rethinking the orthodoxy. A similar pattern emerged in a study of students who graduated at the top of their class. Education researcher Karen Arnold explains, "Valedictorians aren't likely to be the future's visionaries. They typically settle into the system instead of shaking it up." That's what I saw with my straight-A students. They were terrified of being wrong. To give them a strong incentive to take some risks, I made the assignment worth 20% of their final grade. I had changed the rules. Now they were being rewarded for rethinking instead of regurgitating. I wasn't sure if that incentive would work until I reviewed the work of a trio of straight-A students. They gave their mini TED Talk about the problems with TED Talks, pointing out the risks of reinforcing short attention spans and privileging superficial polish over deep insight. Their presentation was so thoughtful and entertaining that I played it for the entire class. As we laughed, they deadpanned, "If you have the courage to stand up to the trend towards glib, seamless answers, then stop watching this video right now and do some real research like we did." I made the assignment a staple of the course from then on. The following year, I wanted to go further in rethinking the content and format of my class. In a typical 3-hour class, I would spend no more than 20 to 30 minutes lecturing. The rest is active learning. Students make decisions in simulations and negotiate in role plays. And then we debrief, discuss, debate, and problem solve. My mistake was treating the syllabus as if it were a formal contract. Once I finalized it in September, it was effectively set in stone. I decided it was time to change that and invite the students to rethink part of the structure of the class itself. On my next syllabus, I deliberately left one class session completely blank. Halfway through the semester, I invited the students to work in small groups to develop and pitch an idea for how we should spend that open day. Then they voted. One of the most popular ideas came from Lauren McCann, who suggested a creative step toward helping students recognize that rethinking was a useful skill, and one they had already been using in college. She invited her classmates to write letters to their freshman selves, covering what they wish they had known back then. The students encouraged their younger selves to stay open to different majors, instead of declaring the first one that erased their uncertainty. To be less obsessed with grades and more focused on relationships. To explore different career possibilities, rather than committing too soon to the one that promised the most pay or prestige. Lauren collected letters from dozens of students to launch a website, Dear Penn Freshman. Within 24 hours, DearPennFresh.com had over 10,000 visits, and a half dozen schools were starting their own versions to help students rethink their academic, social, and professional choices. This practice can extend far beyond the classroom. As we approach any life transition, whether it's a first job, a second marriage, or a third child, we can pause to ask people what they wish they'd known before they went through that experience. Once we're on the other side of it, we can share what we ourselves should have rethought. It's been demonstrated repeatedly that one of the best ways to learn is to teach. It wasn't until I let my students design a day of class that I truly understood how much they had to teach one another and me. They were rethinking not just what they learned, but whom they could learn from. The following year, the class's favorite idea took that rethinking a step further. The students hosted a day of passion talks on which anyone could teach the class about something he or she loved. We learned how to beatbox and design buildings that mesh with nature and make the world more allergy safe. From that point on, sharing passions has been part of class participation. All the students give a passion talk as a way of introducing themselves to their peers. Year after year, they tell me that it injects a heightened level of curiosity into the room, leaving them eager to soak up insights from each of their classmates. When I asked a handful of education pioneers to name the best teacher of rethinking they've ever encountered, I kept hearing the same name, Ron Berger. If you invited Ron over for dinner, he's the kind of person who would notice that one of your chairs was broken, ask if you had some tools handy, and fix it on the spot. For most of his career, Ron was a public elementary school teacher in rural Massachusetts. His nurse, his plumber, and his local firefighters were all former students. During the summers and on weekends, he worked as a carpenter. Ron has devoted his life to teaching students an ethic of excellence. Mastering a craft, in his experience, is about constantly revising our thinking. Hands-on craftsmanship is the foundation for his classroom philosophy. Ron wanted his students to experience the joy of discovery, so he didn't start by teaching them established knowledge. He began the school year by presenting them with grapples, problems to work through in phases. The approach was think, pair, share. The kids started individually, updated their ideas in small groups, and then presented their thoughts to the rest of the class, arriving at solutions together. Instead of introducing existing taxonomies of animals, for example, Ron had them develop their own categories first. Some students classified animals by whether they walked on land, swam in water, or flew through the air. Others arranged them according to color, size, or diet. The lesson was that scientists always have many options, and their frameworks are useful in some ways, but arbitrary in others. When students confront complex problems, they often feel confused. A teacher's natural impulse is to rescue them as quickly as possible so they don't feel lost or incompetent. Yet psychologists find that one of the hallmarks of an open mind is responding to confusion with curiosity and interest. One student put it eloquently, "I need time for my confusion." Confusion can be a cue that there's new territory to be explored or a fresh puzzle to be solved. Ron wasn't content to deliver lessons that erased confusion. He wanted students to embrace confusion. His vision was for them to become leaders of their own learning, much like they would in do-it-yourself craft projects. He started encouraging students to think like young scientists. They would identify problems, develop hypotheses, and design their own experiments to test them. His sixth graders went around the community to test local homes for radon gas. His third graders created their own maps of amphibian habitats. His first graders got their own group of snails to take care of and went on to test which of over 140 foods they liked and whether they preferred hot or cold, dark or light, and wet or dry environments. For architecture and engineering lessons, Ron had his students create blueprints for a house. When he required them to do at least four different drafts, other teachers warned him that younger students would become discouraged. Ron disagreed. He had already tested the concept with kindergartners and first graders in art. Rather than asking them to simply draw a house, he announced, "We'll be doing four different versions of a drawing of a house." Some students didn't stop there. Many wound up deciding to do 8 or 10 drafts. The students had a support network of classmates cheering them on in their efforts. As Ron reflects, quality means rethinking, reworking, and polishing. They need to feel they will be celebrated, not ridiculed, for going back to the drawing board. They soon began complaining if I didn't allow them to do more than one version. Ron wanted to teach his students to revise their thinking based on input from others, so he turned the classroom into a challenge network. Every week, and sometimes every day, the class would do a critique session. One format was a gallery critique. Ron put everyone's work on display, sent students around the room to observe, and then facilitated a discussion of what they saw as excellent and why. This method wasn't used only for art and science projects. For a writing assignment, they would evaluate a sentence or a paragraph. The other format was an in-depth critique. For a single session, the class would focus on the work of one student or group. The authors would explain their goals and where they needed help, and Ron guided the class through a discussion of strengths and areas for development. He encouraged students to be specific and kind, to critique the work rather than the author. He taught them to avoid preaching and prosecuting. Since they were sharing their subjective opinions, not objective assessments, they should say, "I think," rather than, "This isn't good." He invited them to show humility and curiosity, framing their suggestions in terms of questions like, "I'd love to hear why," and "Have you considered?" The class didn't just critique projects. Every day they would discuss what excellence looked like. With each new project, they updated their criteria. Along with rethinking their own work, they were learning to continually rethink their standards. To help them further evolve those standards, Ron regularly brought in outside experts. Local architects and scientists would come in to offer their own critiques, and the class would incorporate their principles and vocabularies into future discussions. Long after they'd moved on to middle and high school, it was not uncommon for former students to visit Ron's class and ask for a critique of their work. As soon as I connected with Ron Berger, I couldn't help but wish I'd been able to take one of his classes. It wasn't because I had suffered from a lack of exceptional teachers. It was because I had never had the privilege of being in a classroom with a culture like his, with a whole room of students dedicated to questioning themselves and one another. Ron now spends his days speaking, writing, teaching a course for teachers at Harvard, and consulting with schools. He's the chief academic officer of EL Education, an organization dedicated to reimagining how teaching and learning take place in schools. Ron and his colleagues work directly with 150 schools and develop curricula that have reached millions of students. At one of their schools in Idaho, a student named Austin was assigned to make a scientifically accurate drawing of a butterfly. His first draft looked a little bit like if I were playing a game of Pictionary. Not very good. Austin's classmates formed a critique group. They gave him two rounds of suggestions for changing the shape of the wings, and he produced his second and third drafts. The critique group pointed out that the wings were uneven and they'd become the wrong shape. Austin wasn't discouraged. He did a fourth draft and a fifth draft, and eventually they encouraged him to fill in the pattern on the wings and color it in. When Ron showed the completed drawing to a room full of elementary school students in Maine, they gasped in awe at Austin's progress and his final product. It looked like a drawing done by a real artist. And I gasped too, because Austin made these drawings when he was in first grade. Seeing a six-year-old undergo that kind of metamorphosis made me think again about how quickly children can become comfortable rethinking and revising. Ever since, I've encouraged our kids to do multiple drafts of their own drawings. As excited as they were to see their first draft hanging on the wall, they're that much prouder of their fourth version. Few of us will have the good fortune to learn to draw a butterfly with Ron Berger or rewrite a textbook with Aaron McCarthy. Yet all of us have the opportunity to teach more like them. Whomever we're educating, we can express more humility, exude more curiosity, and introduce the children in our lives to the infectious joy of discovery. I believe that good teachers introduce new thoughts, but great teachers introduce new ways of thinking. Collecting a teacher's knowledge may help us solve the challenges of the day, but understanding how a teacher thinks can help us navigate the challenges of a lifetime. Ultimately, education is more than the information we accumulate in our heads. It's the habits we develop as we keep revising our drafts and the skills we build to keep learning. Chapter 10. That's not the way we've always done it. Building cultures of learning at work. If only it weren't for the people, Earth would be an engineer's paradise. Kurt Vonnegut. As an avid scuba diver, Luca Parmitano was familiar with the risks of drowning. He just didn't realize it could happen in outer space. Luca had just become the youngest astronaut ever to take a long trip to the International Space Station. In July 2013, the 36-year-old Italian astronaut completed his first spacewalk, spending 6 hours running experiments, moving equipment, and setting up power and data cables. Now, a week later, Luca and another astronaut, Chris Cassidy, were heading out for a second walk to continue their work and do some maintenance. As they prepared to leave the airlock, they could see the Earth 250 miles below. After 44 minutes in space, Luca felt something strange. The back of his head seemed to be wet. He wasn't sure where the water was coming from. It wasn't just a nuisance. It could cut off communication by shorting out his microphone or earphones. He reported the problem to Mission Control in Houston, and Chris asked if he was sweating. Luca said, "I am sweating, but it feels like a lot of water. It's not going anywhere. It's just in my Snoopy cap. Just FYI." He went back to work. The officer in charge of spacewalks, Karina Eversley, knew something was wrong. "That's not normal," she thought, and quickly recruited a team of experts to compile questions for Luca. Was the amount of liquid increasing? Luca couldn't tell. Was he sure it was water? When he stuck out his tongue to capture a few of the drops that were floating in his helmet, the taste was metallic. Mission Control made the call to terminate the spacewalk early. Luca and Chris had to split up to follow their tethers, which were routed in opposite directions. To get around an antenna, Luca flipped over. Suddenly, he couldn't see clearly or breathe through his nose. Globs of water were covering his eyes and filling his nostrils. The water was continuing to accumulate, and if it reached his mouth, he could drown. His only hope was to navigate quickly back to the airlock. As the sun set, Luca was surrounded by darkness, with only a small headlight to guide him. Then his comms went down too. He couldn't hear himself or anyone else speak. Luca managed to find his way back to the outer hatch of the airlock, using his memory and the tension in his tether. He was still in grave danger. Before he could remove his helmet, he would have to wait for Chris to close the hatch and repressurize the airlock. For several agonizing minutes of silence, it was unclear whether he would survive. When it was finally safe to remove his helmet, a quart and a half of water was in it, but Luca was alive. Months later, the incident would be called the scariest wardrobe malfunction in NASA history. The technical updates followed swiftly. The spacesuit engineers traced the leak to a fan pump separator, which they replaced moving forward. They also added a breathing tube that works like a snorkel and a pad to absorb water inside the helmet. Yet the biggest error wasn't technical. It was human. When Luca had returned from his first spacewalk a week earlier, he had noticed some droplets of water in his helmet. He and Chris assumed they were the result of a leak in the bag that provided drinking water in his suit, and the crew in Houston agreed. Just to be safe, they replaced the bag, but that was the end of the discussion. The space station chief engineer, Chris Hansen, led the eventual investigation into what had gone wrong with Luca's suit. Chris told me, the occurrence of minor amounts of water in the helmet was normalized. In the space station community, the perception was that drink bags leak, which led to an acceptance that it was a likely explanation without digging deeper into it. Luca's scare wasn't the first time that NASA's failure at rethinking had proven disastrous. In 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded after a catastrophically shallow analysis of the risk that circular gaskets, called O-rings, could fail. Although this had been identified as a launch constraint, NASA had a track record of overriding it in prior missions without any problems occurring. On an unusually cold launch day, the O-ring sealing the rocket booster joints ruptured, allowing hot gas to burn through the fuel tank, killing all seven Challenger astronauts. In 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrated under similar circumstances. After takeoff, the team on the ground noticed that some foam had fallen from the ship, but most of them assumed it wasn't a major issue since it had happened in past missions without incident. They failed to rethink that assumption and instead started discussing what repairs would be done to the ship to reduce the turnaround time for the next mission. The foam loss was, in fact, a critical issue. The damage it caused to the wing's leading edge let hot gas leak into the shuttle's wing upon re-entry into the atmosphere. Once again, all seven astronauts lost their lives. Rethinking is not just an individual skill. It's a collective capability, and it depends heavily on an organization's culture. NASA had long been a prime example of a performance culture. Excellence of execution was the paramount value. Although NASA accomplished extraordinary things, they soon became victims of overconfidence cycles. As people took pride in their standard operating procedures, gained conviction in their routines, and saw their decisions validated through their results, they missed opportunities for rethinking. Rethinking is more likely to happen in a learning culture, where growth is the core value and rethinking cycles are routine. In learning cultures, the norm is for people to know what they don't know, doubt their existing practices, and stay curious about new routines to try out. Evidence shows that in learning cultures, organizations innovate more and make fewer mistakes. After studying and advising change initiatives at NASA and the Gates Foundation, I've learned that learning cultures thrive under a particular combination of psychological safety and accountability. Years ago, an engineer-turned-management professor named Amy Edmondson became interested in preventing medical errors. She went into a hospital and surveyed its staff about the degree of psychological safety they experienced in their teams. Could they take risks without the fear of being punished? Then she collected data on the number of medical errors each team made, tracking serious outcomes like potentially fatal doses of the wrong medication. She was surprised to find that the more psychological safety a team felt, the higher its error rates. It appeared that psychological safety could breed complacency. When trust runs deep in a team, people might not feel the need to question their colleagues or double-check their own work. But Edmondson soon recognized a major limitation of the data. The errors were all self-reported. To get an unbiased measure of mistakes, she sent a covert observer into the units. When she analyzed those data, the results flipped. Psychologically safe teams reported more errors, but they actually made fewer errors. By freely admitting their mistakes, they were then able to learn what had caused them and eliminate them moving forward. In psychologically unsafe teams, people hid their mishaps to avoid penalties, which made it difficult for anyone to diagnose the root causes and prevent future problems. They kept repeating the same mistakes. Since then, research on psychological safety has flourished. When I was involved in a study at Google to identify the factors that distinguish teams with high performance and well-being, the most important differentiator wasn't who was on the team or even how meaningful their work was. What mattered most was psychological safety. Over the past few years, psychological safety has become a buzzword in many workplaces. Although leaders might understand its significance, they often misunderstand exactly what it is and how to create it. Edmondson is quick to point out that psychological safety is not a matter of relaxing standards, making people feel comfortable, being nice and agreeable, or giving unconditional praise. It's fostering a climate of respect, trust, and openness in which people can raise concerns and suggestions without fear of reprisal. It's the foundation of a learning culture. In performance cultures, the emphasis on results often undermines psychological safety. When we see people get punished for failures and mistakes, we become worried about proving our competence and protecting our careers. We learn to engage in self-limiting behavior, biting our tongues rather than voicing questions and concerns. Sometimes that's due to power distance. We're afraid of challenging the big boss at the top. The pressure to conform to authority is real, and those who dare to deviate run the risk of backlash. In performance cultures, we also censor ourselves in the presence of experts who seem to know all the answers, especially if we lack confidence in our own expertise. Lack of psychological safety was a persistent problem at NASA. Before the Challenger launch, some engineers did raise red flags but were silenced by managers. Others were ignored and ended up silencing themselves. After the Columbia launch, an engineer asked for clearer photographs to inspect the damage to the wing, but managers didn't supply them. In a critical meeting to evaluate the condition of the shuttle after takeoff, the engineer didn't speak up. About a month before that Columbia launch, Ellen Ochoa became the deputy director of flight crew operations. In 1993, Ellen had made history by becoming the first Latina in space. Now, the first flight she supported in a management role had ended in tragedy. After breaking the news to the space station crew and consoling the family members of the fallen astronauts, she was determined to figure out how she could personally help to prevent this kind of disaster from ever happening again. Ellen recognized that at NASA, the performance culture was eroding psychological safety. She told me, "People pride themselves on their engineering expertise and excellence. They fear their expertise will be questioned in a way that's embarrassing to them. It's that basic fear of looking like a fool, asking questions that people just dismiss, or being told you don't know what you're talking about." To combat that problem and nudge the culture toward learning, she started carrying a 3x5 note card in her pocket with questions to ask about every launch and important operational decision. Her list included, "What leads you to that assumption? Why do you think it's correct? What might happen if it's wrong? What are the uncertainties in your analysis? I understand the advantages of your recommendation. What are the disadvantages?" A decade later, though, the same lessons about rethinking would have to be relearned in the context of spacewalk suits. As flight controllers first became aware of the droplets of water in Luca Parmitano's helmet, they made two faulty assumptions. The cause was the drink bag, and the effect was inconsequential. It wasn't until the second spacewalk, when Luca was in actual danger, that they started to question whether those assumptions were wrong. When engineer Chris Hansen took over as the manager of the extravehicular activity office, he inaugurated a norm of posing questions like Ellen's. As he told me, "All anybody would have had to ask is, how do you know the drink bag leaked?" The answer would have been, "Because somebody told us." That response would have set off red flags. It would have taken 10 minutes to check, but nobody asked. It was the same for Columbia. Boeing came in and said, "This foam, we think we know what did it." If somebody had asked how they knew, nobody could have answered that question. How do you know? It's a question we need to ask more often, both of ourselves and of others. The power lies in its frankness. It's non-judgmental, a straightforward expression of doubt and curiosity that doesn't put people on the defensive. Ellen Ochoa wasn't afraid to ask that question, but she was an astronaut with a doctorate in engineering, serving in a senior leadership role. For too many people in too many workplaces, the question feels like a bridge too far. Creating psychological safety is easier said than done, so I set out to learn about how leaders can establish it. When I first arrived at the Gates Foundation, people were whispering about the annual strategy reviews. It's the time when program teams across the foundation meet with the co-chairs, Bill and Melinda Gates, and the CEO, to give progress reports on execution and collect feedback. Although the foundation employs some of the world's leading experts in areas ranging from eradicating disease to promoting educational equity, these experts are often intimidated by Bill's knowledge base, which seems impossibly broad and deep. What if he spots a fatal flaw in my work? Will it be the end of my career here? A few years ago, leaders at the Gates Foundation reached out to see if I could help them build psychological safety. They were worried that the pressure to present airtight analyses was discouraging people from taking risks. They often stuck to tried-and-true strategies that would make incremental progress, rather than daring to undertake bold experiments that might make a bigger dent in some of the world's most vexing problems. The existing evidence on creating psychological safety gave us some starting points. I knew that changing the culture of an entire organization is daunting, while changing the culture of a team is more feasible. It starts with modeling the values we want to promote, identifying and praising others who exemplify them, and building a coalition of colleagues who are committed to making the change. The standard advice for managers on building psychological safety is to model openness and inclusiveness. Ask for feedback on how you can improve, and people will feel safe to take risks. To test whether that recommendation would work, I launched an experiment with a doctoral student, Konstantinos Koutaferis. In multiple companies, we randomly assigned some managers to ask their teams for constructive criticism. Over the following week, their teams reported higher psychological safety. But as we anticipated, it didn't last. Some managers who asked for feedback didn't like what they heard and got defensive. Others found the feedback useless or felt helpless to act on it, which discouraged them from continuing to seek feedback and their teams from continuing to offer it. Another group of managers took a different approach, one that had less immediate impact in the first week, but led to sustainable gains in psychological safety a full year later. Instead of asking them to seek feedback, we had randomly assigned those managers to share their past experiences with receiving feedback and their future development goals. We advised them to tell their teams about a time when they benefited from constructive criticism and to identify the areas that they were working to improve now. By admitting some of their imperfections out loud, managers demonstrated that they could take it and made a public commitment to remain open to feedback. They normalized vulnerability, making their teams more comfortable opening up about their own struggles. Their employees gave more useful feedback because they knew where their managers were working to grow. That motivated managers to create practices to keep the door open. They started holding Ask Me Anything coffee chats, opening weekly one-on-one meetings by asking for constructive criticism, and setting up monthly team sessions where everyone shared their development goals and progress. Creating psychological safety can't be an isolated episode or a task to check off on a to-do list. When discussing their weaknesses, many of the managers in our experiment felt awkward and anxious at first. Many of their team members were surprised by that vulnerability and unsure of how to respond. Some were skeptical. They thought their managers might be fishing for compliments or cherry-picking comments that made them look good. It was only over time, as managers repeatedly demonstrated humility and curiosity, that the dynamic changed. At the Gates Foundation, I wanted to go a step further. Instead of just having managers open up with their own teams about how they had previously been criticized, I wondered what would happen if senior leaders shared their experiences across the entire organization. It dawned on me that I had a memorable way to make that happen. A few years earlier, our MBA students at Wharton decided to create a video for their annual comedy show. It was inspired by Mean Tweets, the late-night segment on Jimmy Kimmel Live, in which celebrities read cruel tweets about themselves out loud. Our version was Mean Reviews, where faculty members read harsh comments from student course evaluations. Here are some highlights.
This is possibly the worst class I have ever taken in my life. Fair enough.
Professor Lowe should go first to some undergrad or lower profile MBA program to train herself how to teach before coming to a school as reputable and with so high student expectations as Wharton is.
Why do you dress up so much for class? I understand wearing a suit, but the pocket square? It makes me question your maturity and causes me not to respect you as much.
Prof. Sinkinson acts all down with pop culture, but secretly thinks Ariana Grande is a font in Microsoft Word.
I made it a habit to show that video in class every fall, and afterward, the floodgates would open. Students seemed to be more comfortable sharing their criticisms and suggestions for improvement after seeing that although I take my work seriously, I don't take myself too seriously. I sent the video to Melinda Gates, asking if she thought something similar might help with psychological safety in her organization. She not only said yes, she challenged the entire executive leadership team to participate and volunteered to be the first to take the hot seat. Her team compiled criticisms from staff surveys, printed them on note cards, and had her react in real time in front of a camera. She read one employee's complaint that she was like Mary effing Poppins, which was the first time anyone could remember hearing Melinda curse, and explained how she was working on making her imperfections more visible. To test the impact of her presentation, we randomly assigned one group of employees to watch Melinda engage with the tough comments, a second to watch a video of her talking about the culture she wanted to create in more general terms, and a third to serve as a peer control group. The first group came away with a stronger learning orientation. They were inspired to recognize their shortcomings and work to overcome them. Some of the power distance evaporated. They were more likely to reach out to Melinda and other senior leaders with both criticism and compliments. One employee commented, "In that video, Melinda did something that I've not yet seen happen at the foundation. She broke through the veneer. It happened for me when she said, 'I go into so many meetings where there are things I don't know.' I had to write that down because I was shocked and grateful at her honesty." Later, when she laughed, like really belly laughed, and then answered the hard comments, the veneer came off again, and I saw that she was no less of Melinda Gates, but actually a whole lot more of Melinda Gates. It takes confident humility to admit that we're a work in progress. It shows that we care more about improving ourselves than proving ourselves. If that mindset spreads far enough within an organization, it can give people the freedom and courage to speak up. But mindsets aren't enough to transform a culture. Although psychological safety erases the fear of challenging authority, it doesn't necessarily motivate us to question authority in the first place. To build a learning culture, we also need to create a specific kind of accountability, one that leads people to think again about the best practices in their workplace. In performance cultures, people often become attached to best practices. The risk is that once we've declared a routine the best, it becomes frozen in time. We preach about its virtues and stop questioning its vices, no longer curious about where it's imperfect and where it could improve. Organizational learning should be an ongoing activity, but best practices imply it has reached an endpoint. We might be better off looking for better practices. At NASA, although teams routinely debriefed after both training simulations and significant operational events, what sometimes stood in the way of exploring better practices was a performance culture that held people accountable for outcomes. Every time they delayed a scheduled launch, they faced widespread public criticism and threats to funding. Each time they celebrated a flight that made it into orbit, they were encouraging their engineers to focus on the fact that the launch resulted in a success, rather than on the faulty processes that could jeopardize future launches. That left NASA rewarding luck and repeating problematic practices, failing to rethink what qualified as an acceptable risk. And it wasn't for a lack of ability. After all, these were rocket scientists. As Ellen Ochoa observes, when you are dealing with people's lives hanging in the balance, you rely on following the procedures you already have. This can be the best approach in a time-critical situation, but it's problematic if it prevents a thorough assessment in the aftermath. Focusing on results might be good for short-term performance, but it can be an obstacle to long-term learning. Sure enough, social scientists find that when people are held accountable only for whether the outcome was a success or failure, they are more likely to continue with ill-fated courses of action. Exclusively praising and rewarding results is dangerous, because it breeds overconfidence and poor strategies, incentivizing people to keep doing things the way they've always done them. It isn't until a high-stakes decision goes horribly wrong that people pause to re-examine their practices. We shouldn't have to wait until a space shuttle explodes or an astronaut nearly drowns to determine whether a decision was successful. Along with outcome accountability, we can create process accountability by evaluating how carefully different options are considered as people make decisions. A bad decision process is based on shallow thinking. A good process is grounded in deep thinking and rethinking, enabling people to form and express independent opinions. Research shows that when we have to explain the procedures behind our decisions in real time, we think more critically and process the possibilities more thoroughly. Process accountability might sound like the opposite of psychological safety, but they're actually independent. Amy Edmondson finds that when psychological safety exists without accountability, people tend to stay within their comfort zone. And when there's accountability, but not safety, people tend to stay silent in an anxiety zone. When we combine the two, we create a learning zone. People feel free to experiment, and to poke holes in one another's experiments in service of making them better. They become a challenge network. One of the most effective steps toward process accountability that I've seen is at Amazon, where important decisions aren't made based on simple PowerPoint presentations. They're informed by a 6-page memo that lays out a problem, the different approaches that have been considered in the past, and how the proposed solutions serve the customer. At the start of the meeting, to avoid groupthink, everyone reads the memo silently. This isn't practical in every situation, but it's paramount when choices are both consequential and irreversible. Long before the results of the decision are known, the quality of the process can be evaluated based on the rigor and creativity of the author's thinking in the memo, and in the thoroughness of the discussion that ensues in the meeting. In learning cultures, people don't stop keeping score. They expand the scorecard to consider processes as well as outcomes. Even if the outcome of a decision is positive, it doesn't necessarily qualify as a success. If the process was shallow, you were lucky. If the decision process was deep, you can count it as an improvement. You've discovered a better practice. If the outcome is negative, it's a failure only if the decision process was shallow. If the result was negative, but you evaluated the decision thoroughly, you've run a smart experiment. The ideal time to run those experiments is when decisions are relatively inconsequential or reversible. In too many organizations, leaders look for guarantees that the results will be favorable before testing or investing in something new. It's the equivalent of telling Gutenberg you'd only bankroll his printing press once he had a long line of satisfied customers, or announcing to a group of HIV researchers that you'd only fund their clinical trials after their treatments worked. Requiring proof is an enemy of progress. This is why companies like Amazon use a principle of disagree and commit. As Jeff Bezos explained it in an annual shareholder letter, instead of demanding convincing results, experiments start with asking people to make bets. Like, look, I know we disagree on this, but will you gamble with me on it? The goal in a learning culture is to welcome these kinds of experiments, to make rethinking so familiar that it becomes routine. Process accountability isn't just a matter of rewards and punishments. It's also about who has decision authority. In a study of California banks, executives often kept approving additional loans to customers who'd already defaulted on a previous one. Since the bankers had signed off on the first loan, they were motivated to justify their initial decision. Interestingly, banks were more likely to identify and write off problem loans when they had high rates of executive turnover. If you're not the person who greenlit the initial loan, you have every incentive to rethink the previous assessment of that customer. If they've defaulted on the past 19 loans, it's probably time to adjust. Rethinking is more likely when we separate the initial decision makers from the later decision evaluators. For years, NASA had failed to create that separation. Ellen Ochoa recalls that traditionally, the same managers who were responsible for cost and schedule were the ones who also had the authority to waive technical requirements. It's easy to talk yourself into something on a launch day. The Columbia disaster reinforced the need for NASA to develop a stronger learning culture. On the next space shuttle flight, a problem surfaced with the sensors in an external engine tank. It recurred several more times over the next year and a half, but it didn't create any observable problems. In 2006, on the day of a countdown in Houston, the whole mission management team held a vote. There was overwhelming consensus that the launch should go forward. Only one outlier had voted no, Ellen Ochoa. In the old performance culture, Ellen might have been afraid to vote against the launch. In the emerging learning culture, she explains, it's not just that we're encouraged to speak up, it's our responsibility to speak up. Inclusion at NASA is not only a way to increase innovation and engage employees, it directly affects safety, since people need to feel valued and respected in order to be comfortable speaking up. In the past, the onus would have been on her to prove it was not safe to launch. Now, the onus was on the team to prove it was safe to launch. That meant approaching their expertise with more humility, their decision with more doubt, and their analysis with more curiosity about the causes and potential consequences of the problem. After the vote, Ellen received a call from the NASA administrator in Florida, who expressed surprising interest in rethinking the majority opinion in the room. He told her, "I'd like to understand your thinking." And they went on to delay the launch. Ellen reflects, Some people weren't happy we didn't launch that day. But people did not come up to me and berate me in any way or make me feel bad. They didn't take it out on me personally. The following day, all the sensors worked properly. But NASA ended up delaying 3 more launches over the next few months due to intermittent sensor malfunctions. At that point, the manager of the shuttle program called for the team to stand down until they identified the root cause. Eventually, they figured out that the sensors were working fine. It was the cryogenic environment that was causing a faulty connection between the sensors and computers. Ellen became the deputy director and then the director of the Johnson Space Center. And NASA went on to execute 19 consecutive successful space shuttle missions before retiring the program. In 2018, when Ellen retired from NASA, a senior leader approached her to tell her how her vote to delay the launch in 2006 had affected him. He said, "I never said anything to you 12 years ago, but it made me rethink how I approach launch days and whether I'm doing the right thing." We can't run experiments in the past. We can only imagine the counterfactual in the present. We can wonder whether the lives of 14 astronauts would have been saved if NASA had gone back to rethink the risks of O-ring failures and foam loss before it was too late. We can wonder why those events didn't make them as careful in reevaluating problems with spacesuits as they had become with space shuttles. In cultures of learning, we're not weighed down with as many of these questions, which means we can live with fewer regrets.